You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be one, can be one. Many stones can form an arch, singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. It's June 8th, 2023. Tonight's show is being underwritten by American Postal Workers 67 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers 1464. American Postal Workers 67, we sort the mail every day and we remind you to register to vote and support causes which help working people. And the IBEW Local 1464 is a labor union that represents nearly 800 workers in Missouri and Kansas, primarily utility workers and some in manufacturing. We strive to improve the lives of working people. When your power goes out, our members turn it back on. IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, the Kansas City Labor Beacon is under new ownership, the Kansas City AFL-CIO. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll hear from Labor Beacon editor Tristan Nemezquah-Hogan and publisher Abril Negrete about the past, present, and future of the paper. Then in our continuing labor leader series, we'll talk to Steelworkers District 11 Director Emil Ramirez about his almost 40 years as a union leader, starting as a pipe fitter for the gas company in Topeka. We'll ask about his history and his vision for the future of the labor movement. In the news, Hollywood actors vote overwhelmingly to strike. DeSantis' anti-immigrant bill paves the way for his candidacy, but maybe rotten tomatoes for the state's ag industry. It's pledge week, everybody. Get out your debit cards. The Heartland Labor Forum is everywhere you want to be. And now the news.
And now news from our side, June 8th, 2023. It looks like Hollywood writers have just doubled down on their strike of 11,000 of the people who write the scripts for all kinds of entertainment. Writers, members of the National Writers Guild, have now been on strike for over 3 weeks, and now they may be joined by the SAG-AFTRA. That's the actors. Their union announced yesterday that 97% of its 160,000 members employed in the TV and film productions have voted to authorize a strike. Their contract is expiring on June 30th. The payday report says that if SAG-AFTRA chooses to strike alongside the 11,000 members of the Writers Guild, it could add an additional pressure in settling a first contract. SAG-AFTRA President Fran Drescher said, "Our union strength lies in our solidarity, and we look forward to a future where this spirit of unity among creative professionals continues, not just throughout the negotiation process, but in the years ahead."
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis took a page out of Donald Trump's playbook by starting his campaign for president by bashing immigrants. DeSantis pushed and his legislature passed Senate Bill 1718, possibly the most xenophobic anti-immigrant law in the nation. It will strengthen employment requirements, forcing most employers to use E-Verify on penalty of losing their business license, requiring hospitals that accept Medicaid to ask patients about their citizenship, and turning information over to the state, turning state law enforcement into immigration cops, and appropriating $12 million from the General Revenue Fund for the governor's unauthorized alien transport program, for which he is now being accused of human trafficking. There are many other provisions, too. What's got lots of people asking is whether DeSantis wants to sacrifice the Florida economy in order to one-up Trump in his bid for the nomination. Florida is a huge agricultural producer, and guess who does much of the work? That's right, immigrants, many of whom are undocumented. While some are preparing to leave the state, many are in the streets protesting. Last week, there were demonstrations in six Florida cities, including Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, and the farming communities of Immokalee and Pearson, while some businesses across the state shut their doors.
On Saturday, Representative Emmanuel Cleaver held his annual barbecue picnic on the lawn at IBEW Local 124. Hundreds were in attendance, including many union brothers and sisters, as Cleaver introduced keynote Representative Jamie Raskin. Raskin represents Maryland's 8th Congressional District and includes Washington, D.C. suburbs. He is recovering from chemotherapy for cancer and wore a bandana to cover his baldness. Cleaver wore one in solidarity. Raskin gained national fame as the chief prosecutor in Trump's second impeachment trial and also on January 6th committee. His book about that and the suicide of his son was a bestseller. It's called Unthinkable. Before entering politics, Raskin was a constitutional law professor and, true to form, turned his picnic speech into a brilliant lecture in defense of democracy and on what the Republicans got wrong about the Constitution. Ranging from the myth that we are a Christian nation to the falsehood that a republic is not a democracy to a total undoing of the NRA and companies' arguments on the Second Amendment and the right of everyone to own an AR-15, Raskin held the crowd spellbound for almost half an hour. In the process, he distinguished himself as a solid advocate for democracy and paid enormous tribute to unions as a key to it. And the news from our side was read tonight by Tom Gibkin, Judy Morgan, and I'm Stephen Hill. And this week, we're having Pledge Drive. If you tune in to KKFI at any time, whether it's for the Heartland Labor Forum or for the blues or in the middle of the night, you know KKFI is different, original, and holy Kansas City. That's because it's non-commercial and independent, and you can listen to free. It's free of advertising, but producing radio 24/7 isn't, of course, free. It takes a lot to keep it going, which is why we have pledge drives. If you could take the time to make a pledge during the show or anytime at www.kkfi.org or calling 888-931-0901, you can be sure to say love to Heartland Labor Forum because we love you. And I've got Tom and Judy. They're prominent members of Heartland Labor Forum. Tom, Judy, you got some words for us about the meaning of the show?
Oh, sure. I started on the show. This is actually my second stint. Judy Ansel, one of our original founders, who is still with us to this day after 30-plus years.
30-plus.
Amazing woman who keeps us all going. Started this program because labor unions were not being represented in the media, and right. She wanted to make sure that they were represented in the media at that point in time. And of course, tonight we also have the Labor Beacon with us, who's another outlet for the unions in Kansas City. So I'm just real happy to be part of this. What always amazes me about KKFI in general is so many of us volunteer to make this work.
That's right.
And that we have an amazing group of volunteers, and we'd really appreciate your support. And I didn't write that number down, but what was that number?
Well, that's 888-931-0901. And Tom?
And that's 888-931-0901. And one thing about Kansas City is they have press, they have radio. They have the media breakfast once a month where labor meets with the press and talks about things, and that way we can get our message out, which is what we want you to hear. Sometimes other press other than the Labor Beacon that we're going to listen to tonight and our friends, they don't put out correct correctly, so we have to go in and meet with our friends and get the right message out. And we're able to do that. And we're able to have the Heartland Labor Forum because of people like you who donate to the KKFI 90.1.
Yeah, that's right. So again, that address is kkfi.org, and give us a call at 888-931-0901. And we're going to shift into programming now.
Oh, we are the men of the Steelworkers Union, from blast furnace, open hearth, foundry, and mill. From ingot mold stripping, from scarfing and chipping, from out where the slack pots are dumped on the fill. There's men from Cape Breton and men from Vancouver, Algoma and Stelco and old Montreal. There's men from Belle Isle and from Prairie and Highland.
And that song that you just heard was United Steelworkers We Are by Joe Glazier. I'm Tom Gebkin, and I'll be co-hosting this segment with Judy Morgan. She's president emeritus of AFT Local 691 and a former state rep that did 9 years and then was forced to term out. The Kansas City Labor Beacon has a long and rich history of providing great information about what's going on in the Kansas City labor movement. The longtime owners, Kevin and Gay O'Neill, recently sold the paper to the Kansas City AFL-CIO. On tonight's show, we're happy to have the editor and the publisher of the paper, Tristan Amezcua Hogan and Abril Negrete, to discuss where the Labor Beacon has been and where it's going. Guys, we want to welcome you to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks.
Yes, welcome from me, too. Many of the people who are listening tonight to our show also read the Labor Beacon, since we're two of the outlets that do a lot of the labor union news. As Tom mentioned in the introduction, longtime owners Kevin and Gay O'Neill recently sold the paper to the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO. Talk to our audience about the sale of the Labor Beacon and the transition between owners.
Kevin and Gay O'Neill sold the paper at the very beginning of the year. January 1st, 2023, papers were signed over, and Union Inc., a company owned by the Kansas City AFL-CIO, took over ownership. Since that point, me and Abril have been operating the paper together. I think that it's gone very well. The biggest thing is that we've changed the formatting for the paper. We've made some slight changes as far as how our graphic size, ad size, things along that nature run. And I think that what we're really building it for is how do we properly transition this paper leading into a more modern media market.
I'd like to say I remember Kevin from the days even before I was president of the teachers union, so that goes back to probably the early 1990s when he first started the paper, and you know, he just always had that friendly smile on his face and attended all of our events, and I think all of us in the labor movement really appreciated him. And then of course his wife stepped in when he went to the city council, so we just want to give a shout out to Kevin and Gay for all their hard work over the years on the paper. So now it's the two of you.
That's
correct. You're the entire staff.
Yeah, we're the entire staff. I was organizing with CWA when Union Inc., or what was about to become Union Inc., reached out to me and asked me if I would be willing to join on this project. And Tristan and I have just been building this plane as we fly it, but it was also flying already.
No, absolutely. And I think that just to mention the tribute to Kevin and Gay, I really think that what they did is really undervalued in it, not just in the union world, I think that everyone you'll find on deep appreciators, but also across the Kansas City market. We're very blessed to have such a lively labor media apparatus, regularly going out to union members, regularly providing education, texting, like, political news, union news, building news, whatever it might be. And Kevin and Gay really, this was their baby. They spent decades working on it and building it up to what it is today.
So what's it like now with the AFL-CIO, Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO is the owner and you the staff? What's the relationship like?
Well, I wasn't there to work with Gay and Kevin, but as far as what it's like now, it's a very useful way to have doors opened for us, to have communication with leaders here in the city and outside of our city as well. It's an amazing amount of power.
I think to add to that, the Abril's right, like the ownership of the by the AFL-CIO of the paper really allows a little more immediacy as far as responses go, as far as like access to calendars and access to understandings of what's happening that previously we kind of had to ask for, which I think has been a very positive change. And it also, I mean, it makes us have a better product in the day because we're spending less time getting there and more time spending time on the thing when we're there. So
you're kind of at ground zero, and so the information fuels its way to you a little faster.
Absolutely, Tom.
Now, before I get to the next question, I just want to say that Kevin and Gay, they're just nice people. They're about as good of people as you can get. Well, the Labor Beacon covers national, regional, and local items. And anyone who's interested in labor union issues, they can find something in each paper that appeals to them. What are your plans for the paper moving forward?
I think that as we look at what is the role of a labor newspaper in 2023, and we really have to reflect on like what is the role it's currently playing in a household, how does it interact with families, how does it interact with regularity as far as contact between unions and their membership, and also just politicians and the membership. So we really act as an outlet for all of that. As we look into the future, I think what's most important to us is finding ways to continue to maintain those new relationships. There's been so much change over in the political scene and the union leadership scene, but then also starting to make plans to transition the paper into whether that be a more digital experience or some combination of thereof. I think that what's really important to us now, and it's also, if you've noticed, the Labor Beacon we refer to now as the Labor Beacon instead of the Kansas City Labor Beacon, because our plans really are to be quite regional. We want to make sure that, sure, Kansas City will always be the home and the focus point of this publication, but as we go into the future, it's important to us that we can scale into Kansas, we can scale into Western Missouri, and we can really tackle anywhere. We have membership that reads in Iowa and Nebraska on the regular anyways. We want to become very much the labor newspaper for, you know, Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas.
How do you financially support the paper, and has that changed from when it was under Kevin and Gay's ownership to now? Is it similar or different?
Almost the exact same model. At the end of the day, obviously, the unions bought it from Kevin and Gay O'Neill, and what we're doing now is the exact same model. Member or unions pay for the membership's paper. Then we use that to cover operating costs, cover mailing costs, cover print costs, you name it, which I also think that the rising costs as far as USPS go, largely because of the onslaught of conservative attacks on USPS, have really made it quite expensive to mail. We're having to look at what our options are, because for us, we're spending a lot of our union dues are being spent on mailing costs right now. So we have to look at how that interacts with what the future looks like.
Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're talking to the editor and the publisher of the Labor Beacon, Tristan Amazquah-Hogan and Abril Negrete.
When you were talking about reaching out beyond the geographical area, and you send papers to Iowa and to the middle of Kansas, how do those folks even find out about the Labor Beacon to want to?
The unique thing is that depending on the union they're part of, jurisdictional lines aren't clean. So while one union may have jurisdiction only in 7 counties on the western side of Missouri, another union may have jurisdiction across the entirety of Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri already. So we're already mailing to those members. So what we really want to do is, how do we add in the other unions that are in those areas? So like if we're mailing to bricklayers that are already in Omaha, how do we add in IBW? How do we add in plumbers? And how do we make sure that like those members that are in those cities are having an experience that reflects what they need to know in their area and reflects also their core values? I think that you'll find that Midwestern values are pretty consistent across our publication area. What's most important to us, though, is that we find a way to expand that and expand it in a way that delivers a benefit, not just for the purpose of expanding.
So you talked about digital. I want to talk a little bit more about that. Do you have a digital presence now?
Yeah, we have a website. But our current website is still under KC Labor Beacon, and we're looking to, as we move forward, change it to a different domain that'll be more welcoming to a bigger regional presence. But we do have, is it KC Labor Beacon? KClaborBeacon.com.
So do you actually charge individuals who get it digitally, or how does that work?
No, so we put articles in delayed after the newspapers are sent to our subscribers.
You can also access more archived versions of the Labor Beacon on the website. And we do now have a presence on Instagram as well, so you can follow us at the Labor Beacon on Instagram.
Okay, that's good.
I would say that the Instagram is the most fun way to follow the Labor Beacon.
Okay. Well, some unions have members who speak English as a second language, and we've noticed that recent issues have published articles in both English and Spanish. So what prompted the Labor Beacon to do this?
Well, and I was going to mention this earlier when we were talking about expansion. Like, as we look into expanding into Kansas, the workforce there just looks dramatically different in a lot of regions. But even so, where we are now, the workforce is different and it's changing. A lot of workers that live in poverty, like a lot of SEIU members, are Spanish speakers. And as the workforce changes, we want the newspaper to be more inclusive and also be able to, I don't know, potentially be an organizing tool as well to get folks more involved in their unions that maybe they wouldn't have felt welcome being more of a part of. Like, I was at the Laborers 264 retirees lunch, and there were no Spanish speakers there, but the retirees were so excited that there were Spanish articles being included in the newspaper, because this meant that there were going to be new people that were going to know that the union was for everybody. And they said that even if we, and we intend to have our articles that are in Spanish to also be in English, but they specifically said that they want them in Spanish and English because they want to know what's happening in these communities and what labor issues are affecting communities that speak Spanish.
So it sounds like you're going to continue to publish articles in both Spanish and English.
Absolutely.
And how do you determine which ones you're going to do that way?
Well, honestly, we were kind of testing the waters with the first few. As we move forward, it's going to come down to what issues are affecting these communities. Like, right now, the big thing is 2350 out in Kansas, that the smuggling law, that is a law that directly affects our workers. So the answer is I don't know, but we're going to figure this one out kind of as we move forward.
I think that what Abril's done has been really excellent in this regard. Having this expanded world, I always talk about the role that the Labor Beacon plays as far as interacting with individuals' homes. And even if the worker that is in the union speaks English, the members of their home at home may primarily speak Spanish. So what this is doing, and what the strength of the Labor Beacon has always been, is been a device that interacts with not just one person, but an entire household on a consistent basis. It sits on the kitchen counter, it sits in the bathroom, it sits on the kitchen, you know, it sits on the kitchen table, and members flip through it throughout the weeks. The benefit of the Labor Beacon is that it has like a tangible residing value, and in these households, as they come to know that there are articles that will be relevant to Spanish-speaking communities, it'll have more of a hold. It's all about transitioning a paper to make it have a benefit for everyone else.
And something that I used to organize with Stand Up KC, fast food workers, and something that we would tell these workers is, as an American worker, as a worker in America, you have rights as a worker. And it doesn't matter what your documentation status is, you still have rights. And I think that's something that's really important to share.
So a lot of unions use this paper to communicate with their members. Do you hear from the readers? And if so, you know, what are their comments? And do they have any requests from you all?
I think that we absolutely hear from members. I think the biggest thing we hear from members is, I would say the biggest thing is that they want us to cover issues that they're seeing in other publications, and they want us to do it from a labor standpoint. The other thing we see a lot, and I think it's going to tie into your Mr. Ramirez guest later on to the steelworkers, is that members tell other workers about things they see in the Labor Beacon. We're about to expand and have the steelworkers added on as subscribers to the paper on a regular basis, which is a huge move for us, and we're very excited because we get to cover things in a very new world. And a big thing that helped prompt that is that steelworker membership was being told on a regular basis by members of other unions that they need to be reading the Labor Beacon. They need to be, you know, they need to be reading these articles. Did you see this? Did you see that? That interacts with you. And I think that that's really where our strength is. When members do interact with us, though, either I made a spelling mistake or they've read something interesting they want it republished in Labor Beacon from a local context.
I know that I get calls in during the day at the Union Hall from people who read items in the Labor Beacon and they have follow-up questions and stuff. So, yeah, the more we can get it out to all of the labor community, the better off we are as a whole. I know that I see you guys at a lot of events and meetings. You're covering a wide range of items, and important not just to union members, but to everyone in the city. Talk to our listeners about the events, and how do you decide which ones to cover? Because you're at a lot, and there's a lot to cover.
Well, we're able to split up now. For something like really big, say there's like a politician, a big announcement that we know is going to happen, we'll both be there. And or if there's like a lot of crowds, a lot of pictures, let's say a golf tournament, we'll split the turf up and try to like divide and conquer real quickly. But yeah, if not, we just kind of switch back and forth.
I think it's definitely a back and forth, and also a split on labor whenever possible to make sure that we're carrying similar loads. At the end of the day, the Labor Beacon is also a unionized staff. I mean, the two of us are members of Laborers Local 264, and we want to make sure that we, in our own practice, reflect a work-life balance that is what we preach. We want to make sure that what we're doing and what we're advocating for, and also like the example we're laying out, is something that reflects what a unionized life should look like. 8 hours work, 8 hours play, 8 hours rest for now, and, you know, it'll be better. So I think that the big thing is making sure that we act as a team whenever possible.
So are you able to stay to that 8 hours a day?
No, not often. in reality, you can't run a newspaper on a staff of two and have 8 hour days. I think that usually I'm 12, 12, 12, 10, 8.
And putting out two issues a month.
And you do all the photography too, right?
We do all the photos, all the writing, all the graphics. We design a lot of the advertising for advertisers. We do it all. And also, I think that beyond that, we also you'll look in the paper and you'll find the back four pages of any paper, usually union news, which means that's submitted to us, which always helps because it's, you know, memberships look in there to actually find out what's happening in their specific union. The big thing that we always do is we update it. So that alone, I mean, it's a 6 hour day to make sure we go through all four pages to make sure everything's right.
So you're telling me you just have two staff members, it's you two, and you do all that work. Well, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I think we're probably near the end. It looks like our engineer over there is telling me that we need to wrap up. So I want to thank you so much, Tristan Amasqua, Holgan, and Abril Negrete for being with us this evening. I'm very impressed with the work you do, and I know the labor community is very appreciative for you continuing the tradition of the Labor Beacon. It needs to stay in our hearts and minds. So thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Judy and Tom.
KKFI 90.1 FM is a 100,000-watt beacon of free expression, mutual respect, and collaboration. Since 1988, we have stood by our philosophy of fostering a climate where diverse voices can be heard. Our commitment to diversity in programming and discourse is unwavering. We recognize that within our community, there will be differing opinions, and we celebrate that. At KKFI, we encourage a completely free and open discussion of ideas. We're committed to uplifting the voices underrepresented by mainstream media. Support our dedication to inclusivity and free speech by making a donation at kkfi.org. Together, let's continue to uplift the voices that challenge, inspire, and shape our community.
Oh, we are the men of the Steelworkers Union, from blast furnace, open hearth, foundry, and mill. From ingot mold stripping, from scarfing and chipping, from out where the slack pots are dumped on the fill. There's men from Cape Breton and men from Vancouver, Algoma and Stelco and old Montreal. There's men from Belle Island, from Prairie and Highland. United Steelworkers are we one and all. Now we dig the ore out and we run the smelter. We make the aluminum, pig iron and steel. And we run the rail mills, the wire and nail mills. In industry, steelworkers are the big wheel. We meet and we battle the toughest employers. At threats and injunctions and stooges we laugh. Our leaders are strongest, our locals fight longest. We have the best members, we have the best staff. And if you fancy licking the boots of the boss.
And I am Tom Gepkin, and I'm back on with Judy Morgan. And we're going to also do the second half of the show. And when we think of, and that song again was Steelworkers We Are by Joe Glazier. When we think of United Steelworkers Union, many of us think of workers in hard hats working in a steel mill. That might have been the way it was a long time ago, but today, the USW is in many industries. They may be teachers in universities, taxi drivers, security guards, and many other occupations, all the way to the traditional steel mill worker. On tonight's show, we are honored to have the United Steelworkers Director of Region 11, Emil Ramirez. He's based out of Kansas City, but he travels all over the Midwest as well as regular trips to Washington, D.C., and the United Steelworkers headquarters in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He wears many hats, and he works long and hard for his members, who elected him to the director's position beginning in 2013. Emil has been a steelworker since 1986. Emil, Judy and I want to welcome you to the Heartland Labor Forum.
And thank you, Tom and Judy. It's glad to be back in here.
Good to see you. With COVID, we haven't been able to run into each other a lot, but it's nice to see you this evening.
Thank you.
Tom gave a short list in his introduction of some of the occupations represented by the USW, but the Steelworkers Union actually represents many more. Tell us about the various workers who are members of your union.
You know, and I'm just nationally, you know, we represent about every mining company in the U.S. That's, you know, a real big target because that's where the steel process starts, in up on the Iron Range in Minnesota. We represent miners, healthcare, not only in our district here in District 11, but across our country. We have an excess of over 50,000 healthcare workers that we represent, and that sector is actually growing. Here in the Kansas City area, represent people that work at Sealy and the Mattress Company here also, many different companies in the oil industry, transferring natural gas and oil through pipelines. Our utility workers here that are on both sides of the state line with Spire Energy and Kansas Gas Service. On the north end of the city, we have people that process corn at Ingredion, and we have people that work some public work with Social Security documents in Independence over at the Cave. So, and there's many others. Paper industry is real big for us here in Blue Springs and in Liberty also. But, you know, we're a union that grows through mergers over the years. And the tire industry in 1995, the rubber workers merged into our union.
Oh, okay.
And we've got a large facility in Topeka with about 1,500 workers at the Goodyear facility. And 1,100 workers at Bridgestone Firestone plant in Des Moines, Iowa. Those are the two biggest. The aluminum industry is real big for us nationally, and within our region we have a plant in Davenport, Iowa, that we're over 2,000 members there that work every day in that industry.
So the health, you said you represent about how many healthcare workers? 40,000?
Well, in nationally, it's 50,000.
50,000?
In our region, we have 5,000 healthcare workers, and that's anywhere from nurses to doctors, physician assistants, to CNAs, and so we think that that industry is going to be continue to grow.
So you, with such a wide variety of people that you represent, and I'm guessing that they have various needs that are different depending on what occupation they're in. So how do you serve the needs of a broad range of occupations like that in one union?
Yeah, I think the my perspective is to make sure that we offer top of the line education, labor education for our members, and also make sure that our health and safety and environmental department is, they have access to that to make sure that. But I think it goes back to the education. I think that's where I came from back in the 80s, being involved in our summer education programs. This week, we run two summer education programs for our members, and we have one this week down at the Lake of the Ozarks, and it'll conclude tomorrow. We run another program for the northern part of our district in September in northern Minnesota. But I really truly believe that anytime any of our members, whatever industry they're in or sector that they're in, they request any type of education, whether it's grievance handling, arbitration prep, safety and health training, they're not going to get denied coming to my office and saying, hey, can you arrange for this type of training? That's the key, I believe.
How do negotiations work with all those different types of occupations?
You know, I think that luckily, I have a nice rounded staff of over 22 staff reps that handle those different contracts, and we get support from the national level on our oil national bargaining. I chair our mining some of our mining negotiations with a company called Cleveland Cliffs, and along with that, it's through a master contract. Same with the aluminum industry, the rubber industry. I chair a contract with that, and also with the beverage can industry. So as a director, you're assigned usually different contracts on a national level. And we get plenty of support from our offices in Pittsburgh. But, you know, the smaller shops, it's tough. I mean, we've had some success in previous years, but I think that these small shop companies, you know, they're up against the big corporations, and you've got to continue to work with them to make sure they survive and people have good paying jobs here in our community.
So in terms of the units you represent, what's like a small unit and what's a big unit?
I can tell you, a big unit would be the 2,000 people that work at Davenport, Iowa, with our Conic company, the Lumen company, or Goodyear, 1,500 people that work there. That's the largest that we have in those sectors. Mining industry, we're the same thing. A small unit would be working like at Sealy Mattress Factory here on the Kansas side of the state line, where we have 55 people that work there. Another small group is we just organized some ambulance EMT workers, 35 members, you know, belonging to that unit. So, you know, we're all, I think, from, you know, 20s to, you know, several thousand.
So those smaller units, though, they would actually have to negotiate that contract for that small unit, right? It would be basically negotiating for those 55 folks who
work
at that place.
And all of our negotiations at that level are handled by our staff representatives that works with our local unions. As you may recall, Judy, back in the early 2000 when Armco shut down the steel mill here, we had, you know, a couple thousand workers there, and you know, when 2,000 people, you know, close the shop, you're going to have to find ways to support the other groups, and we went through some amalgamations to where luckily we had some great leaders over the years that were able to carry on skillfully with negotiations, handling grievances, and you know, I think you got to have a real trained staff to continue.
So you're the director of Region 11, and I think you cover a pretty large geographic region. What is it?
So we have 9 states here in the Midwest and on the little fringe of the Northwest Plains. So, you know, besides Minnesota is really our largest area, the state of Iowa, the state of Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana. So It's one of the largest regions in our union. We have 12 directors in the United States and Canada, and I can tell you that I think I probably got the most miles if you're going to go from one point to point A to point B to cover.
Now, is your position an elected position or an appointed position?
You know, it's an elected, as a director, it's an elected position.
Okay, so. How many years?
So I was elected in 2013. I just started my third four-year term last March.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And so it's you're elected along with our international officers at the time.
Well, along those lines, one of the things we like to do in our Labor Leader Series is have you tell us how you decided to become a member of the Steelworkers, and then what made you want to become active in your local, and then go all the way to the top position in Region 11. Tell us about your journey from a pipe fitter working for the gas company to serving more than 34,000 members in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well Tom, I can tell you that it was about this time in 1986 when I went to work for the gas service company in Topeka. And I think the first day on the job, it was probably 100 degrees. And putting a new gas pipe in a street in Topeka. But you know, we had a strong, active local union, and we still do. But the thing was is after I became a member, got sworn in, started attending union meetings, and the thing was that we had some leadership in our local union that were about ready to retire, and they had been in leadership positions for a long time. And I got approached by then the local union president at the time and said, hey, why don't you become a grievance person for the street crew and see how you like that. So I did that, went to a summer school, four-year program to learn more about labor education and how the steelworkers work as far as grievance handling and arbitration negotiations. And in 1988, got to sit in on my first set of negotiations with the gas company, which was a real learning experience for myself. And then became the local union president in 1991, filled an unexpired term, and then ran again, got elected as local union president, and then was asked to come on the international staff in May of 1995. So, you know, you do that, and then kind of move up. You get different assignments as a staff person, and served as assistant director for 8 years, and then my predecessor decided to retire, so I ran for the director's open position in 2013.
How much do you have to travel in your job if you cover 9 states?
Well, I can tell you quite a bit. you probably don't want to look at my calendar. I can tell you, last year was a heavy year of bargaining for myself, the bargaining that I chair. And I thought, okay, maybe 23 is going to be a decent year to where it won't be so much, but more stuff comes on. And I think the responsibility at this level, you got to make sure that, you know, you're going to do everything you can for our members and for our international union.
Let's talk about the mining industry. That sounds like it's an important field represented by your union. So how difficult is it bargaining with the employers in the mining industry, and how does it work? Is there a national contract that gets negotiated for everybody and then local contracts too?
On the mining sector, there's actually U.S. Steel has some mining, and then Cleveland-Cliffs, those are the two big in my region that we have. And I can tell you that we have different people. I chair the Cleveland-Cliffs mining negotiations. Vice President Dave McCall chairs the U.S. Steel bargaining for mining. And in that, in the Cleveland-Cliffs side, we have four local unions that make up that master contract. In the U.S. Steel, there's a lot that's combined along with the steel manufacturing, the steel mills, and there's about 20 local unions in that master agreement. But, you know, it's last year with high inflation, bargaining in that, you know, we came out, did real well. I think the companies recognized they were making big profits, and I can tell you that we held our ground and were pretty successful bargaining in 2023. But mining is difficult, along with the aluminum industry, the rubber industry, just because of the rubber and the aluminum industry, you got so much imports, you know, with other countries. We don't have that much with mining, particularly going to our mills.
We're talking with Emil Ramirez, and he is based out of Kansas City, and he is the director of United Steelworkers Region 11. Where do you see the United Steelworkers going in the future?
Well, I'm kind of encouraged. Tom, I can tell you that, you know, the support for labor unions, I think we all know, is at a 57-year high, and according to a Gallup poll that was done last year, and I think that that's really positive for us. We're seeing an upswing in organizing activity in the steelworkers. You know, employees are demanding, you know, higher wages and better working conditions. I can tell you that in our region, we just hired or just organized 750 new members in Bismarck, North Dakota at a Bobcat facility, and that was followed up months later with 180 new members at another Bobcat facility in Rogers, Minnesota. So that's encouraging. We're organizing healthcare workers. We got some great leads at some manufacturing facilities here in the state of Kansas, across the state line. So I think that you know, in the When you look at what people are asking for, just a fair wage, protections on the job from health and safety, mm-hmm. I think we have a great opportunity to continue to grow our union. Yes, in the 80s, you know, the union density was across the country was around 20%, and now it's, you know, between 10% and 11%, and but we think that's going to continue to grow. I think the American public is seeing that, hey, there is a value to belonging to a labor union.
Yeah, you brought that poll up. The one poll I read, Emil, said that the public now supports labor unions at 71%. Yeah, which is, like you said, is a 57 since 1965. It's the highest it's been. So you're right. The American public is thinking much more positively right. toward labor unions.
And I think to follow up on that too. I mean, look what the voting public did here in Missouri in 2018 mm-hmm. by yes. keeping right to work off by a large number.
Yes,
68%. And mm-hmm. then you look at what happened in Montana, you know, and we've got a large mining density there, and along with some refineries there, which Montana, we had support across the aisle. They kept it off the ballot. And then just here in March, you know, in Michigan, where they overturned, mm-hmm. you know, right to work. So I think, you know, we're trending the right way. It is across the aisle to make sure that you know, people understand the benefit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time. Thank you, Emil Ramirez, for being with us tonight and telling us about the United Steelworkers. He's director of Region 11, and in his, I believe you said, third term.
Yes.
And you taught us a lot about the United Steelworkers, and thank you for your service. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you both, Tom and Judy. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. They're lucky to have you at United Steelworkers.
All right. Thank you.
And KKFI is lucky to have guests like you, Mr. Ramirez. That can only be done through the power of community. And speaking of community, we have a gentleman of the community coming up, Michael Savoie. We're moving into more Pledge Week action for the station. Michael, did you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, you know, I was prompted on the way over. I was listening, and you guys were talking a little about KKFI history.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I happen to know a little bit about that because I guess I'm telling my age, but I had some friends who were part of the Mid-Coast Radio Project back in about 1986.
My.
And their vision was to create a community radio station. Now, I can't begin to tell you about all the hurdles that they had to get over to do that. But I saw it you know, the bosses have their radio stations. That's the entire media.
That's right.
And we, the working people, needed a station of our own. And my God, fast forward, why this vision of KKFI has become more than I ever dreamed, because it serves the needs of not just working class, the broad spectrum of humanity is served by this station. You know, so it's really been a vision become reality, you know, and community radio has become the voice of the people of Kansas City, not just union people, not just working people, but all people. And that, my God, is quite an achievement in a arena that is so traditionally hostile to the people having a voice. So, you know, it's it warms my heart, and it certainly keeps me involved. And while I wasn't involved at that time, I was shortly thereafter, off and on, as I completed my career. And since I've retired, well, of course, I've been a part of this Heartland Labor Forum for probably about 12 years, consistently, you see. So anyway, yeah, I would encourage all our listeners to support KKFI, you know. Call that number, 888-931-0901. Make your pledge today, as I did a little earlier.
Yeah, yeah, you got it memorized. We just had a pledge come in. That was $275 from our host, Judy Ansel. She wins the champion donation for the hour. And you heard Michael Savoy. He just donated. You too can donate at 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org. Tom, Judy, did you have anything else you wanted to add? You always have a community-centric interviews. Everybody has, you're on the pulse there.
Well, you know, Tom's the one who came up with the idea for the Labor Leader series.
Oh, nice.
Probably about getting close to a couple of years ago now, I think. And so somehow we got together teaming up from the very beginning doing it. And it's really been fun to work with Tom. And I had a chance to interview the KC Tenants with Michael back about a little over a year ago. And I really enjoyed co-hosting the program with him, too. So it's a lot of fun being on KKFI, and I think Michael really covered it well in terms of how it really affects the whole community.
Absolutely.
It started out with labor unions, and I think then we broadened to include more working people issues in general, but it just really, I think, fulfills a need that's here in Kansas City and other places, too.
The voice of the working class.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. You can listen for free. It's free of advertising. But, of course, it's not free to run the actual radio station, unfortunately. So if you can make that pledge during the show or any time at kkfi.org or call us at 888-931-0901. And be sure to say you love Heartland Labor Forum. Is anybody else have anything before we...
How long has the Heartland Labor Forum been on? 33 years?
I think since its inception. It was shortly thereafter, if not... I would say close to 35, close to the entire time it's been on.
Yeah,
and it has won national awards for some of the things it's
absolutely
produced.
Kind of have set the bar, in a sense, of labor radio across the country. And it's encouraged a lot of others as well.
That's right. It broke the mold, as it were.
We did a really fun show, I think, at the end of 2022, where we, all the Heartland Labor Forum volunteer programmers gave their predictions for the new year.
That was fun.
That was a fun show, and I think we're maybe going to make that an annual thing. And then we're also going to go back and see how good we were at our predictions, if we were right or wrong. So that'll be interesting, too.
Oh, that'll be great. Look into that crystal ball. Well, again, that number is 888-931-0901. And see us anytime at kkfi.org. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, sheltered workshops and 22 cents an hour, the fight to ban the sub-minimum wage. And the Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. I'm Stephen Hill. I'm in for Judy Ansel. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special, and stay safe, everyone.
listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforum@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be. He said if I were Frank Sinatra, I'd pull strings, and through political pull, you'd be on top of the glorified garbage pile with all of their plastic smiles. You'd be with all the self-appointed kings and queens, with all their power and wealth and the material things that symbolize the greed that's keeping the world in need. And you would be the darling of the Reagans and the Trump son, never to acknowledge the conditions where you've come from, to struggle and fight for the common man's rights. To be in the working class is good enough for me. Can deny that you could build a private heaven and think of all the kinds that you would never have to let in. But keep this in mind, you're not gonna find the meaning of paradise, 'cause life's for those who share. There is no disgrace in standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage is something to be proud of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be. The working class, and that's the place to be. 'Cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.